Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us today is Dr. David Penn, a neurosurgeon with advanced training and expertise in complex brain tumors, skull base surgery, and cerebrovascular neurosurgery. He cares for people with arteriovenous malformations, brain aneurysms, brain tumors, including the latest endoscopic surgical care for pituitary tumors. A Mount Kisco native, Dr. Penn trained at Duke, Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University, and Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard. He sees patients at Northwell Health Neurosurgery in Poughkeepsie. If you have a question today, call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Penn, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me this
afternoon.
It's been
a while. When were you on last? My memory's very
either
poor.
A year or 2 years ago. We might have skipped a year. I forget.
Fair enough. Well, that explains why it was a little cloudy in my memory.
Yes.
So we had an email earlier today, and I showed it to you before the show. It was about a tumor in the parotid gland.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, well, that's not really my thing. So maybe you can explain the division of responsibilities among doctors when it comes to the head.
Sure. So with the head itself, there are a lot of different, let's call them compartments. As a neurosurgeon, I specialize in working within the skull for the most part, the skull and the spine. There are obviously parts outside of the skull that can come down with problems. The parotid gland is one of them. So there are surgeons who specialize in working in some of those soft tissue structures below the skull. There are head and neck surgeons, ear, nose, and throat surgeons. And as neurosurgeons, we actually collaborate a lot with those other specialties because sometimes the pathology doesn't follow the rules of the box or the compartments, so to speak. So sometimes you will have a brain tumor that extends into a space that we're not familiar with working with. And in our hospital, we have a lot of great subspecialists, and that provides us the opportunity to work together in teams and really develop great care for patients.
You know, every time I have a brain surgeon on this show, I think of those old Hammer Frankenstein movies where he took a saw and cut the top of a guy's head off. Now, things have improved since the 1800s, right?
It's a little more elegant than that now, I would like to think. One of the initial inventions for getting into the skull was actually something called the jiggly saw. What you would do is you'd create a couple of holes in the skull, and you'd pass, for lack of a better word, almost a piece of barbed wire between those two holes.
Through the head, inside.
Mm-hmm. And you would pull that wire back and forth till you could create an opening in the skull and remove the bone. Fortunately, now we use power tools, right? So we have, you know, if anyone's a shop worker, a Dremel, it almost looks like a little bit of a Dremel, right? So we can put holes in the skull and then connect those holes with an electric device that looks a little bit like a Dremel or a jigsaw or something like that. So it's a little more elegant, but, you know, when they first started doing this, it was not so elegant.
Yeah, I know. I've seen the films. We talked to many surgeons on this program, and one of the things that is on the up and up and coming more and more each day is this non-invasive surgery. But with the brain, it's pretty tough to do, right?
So we've gotten better at creating minimally invasive techniques. I'm always careful with that term, minimally invasive brain surgery, because even though this incision's small or there's lack of incision, it doesn't mean that we can't have problems. But one of the types of surgeries I specialize is there's a particular set of tumors that we can access through the nose. And that's nice because we don't leave scars. And a lot of those tumors that we're accessing through the nose are easily accessible through that route. But
how do you see what you're doing?
We use endoscopes. So similar to, you know, when you think about a laparoscopic abdominal surgery, it's basically a camera on a stick. So you can pass the camera through the nose, and the big advantage is actually now your visualization is right in the area you're working, your light and your camera, and you can really see everything. And now with the explosion of technology, the high definition cameras and things like that, everything's very clear. So in some ways, it actually makes the surgery a little easier and a little safer. But we can work through that passageway of the nose to get to some of the tumors at the base of the skull.
Our number here, by the way, is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined by Dr. David Penn from Northwell Health in Poughkeepsie. So that's what, the Vassar Brothers?
Vassar Brothers Medical Center, yes.
Some emails here have come in. This is one from Anne. My 70-year-old mother's planning to undergo surgery and have a shunt placed in her brain. She recently had lumbar puncture and it improved her symptoms of ataxia, inability to walk and extremely poor balance. She previously was found to have normal pressure in her brain, but the thought is still that fluid may be causing her symptoms. She's now planning to have a shunt placed to drain the fluid. I'm very worried about her, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for improving this condition that do not involve such invasive surgery. And that's from Anne.
So it sounds like she has a condition called normal pressure hydrocephalus, which exactly as she described, the pressure in the head isn't high. But sometimes what can happen is that low pressure of spinal fluid can place a little bit of stress on some of the fibers that run within the center of the brain. And what we found is if you drain some of that spinal fluid, it can improve those symptoms, the biggest of which that can improve is the gait problems or the walking problems, ataxia, which she described. Unfortunately, there are not many minimally invasive, you know, medicines or things like that that can improve that condition. And the general, the tried and true treatment is drainage of spinal fluid, which is through that shunt procedure. The one thing that I would try to reassure you is that in general, shunts are very low risk. Sure, it is a major surgery where we pass a catheter through the brain, but that comes with a low risk profile. For the most part, there are a lot of people that have those shunts, and it's usually very successful at relieving the symptoms. It sounds like the doctors that she's working with have done the appropriate things and tested everything before they're doing this, you know, more invasive procedure. But unfortunately, right now, the other treatment options are low.
What percentage of your cases that you work on can be done minimally invasively? I mean, do you have to go in and most often?
A lot of times we're going in some way.
Yeah.
Right? Even though the incision is small, like I said, it's still brain surgery.
Have you thought about it? I'm not asking you for specific statistics, but how long does the average brain surgery patient have to remain in the hospital?
Depends on the type of surgery. I usually tell most of my healthy patients after a brain surgery, you're probably in the hospital on average 2 to 4 days.
Really?
People are getting
That's
out
all.
Of it's not that bad. Yeah.
How do you know you got it right?
The average or the
surgery?
The surgery? We're a lot of experience.
Yeah.
A lot of experience, a lot of practice.
That's a stressful gig. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined by neurosurgeon David Penn. Dr. David Penn is with Northwell Health Neurosurgery at Poughkeepsie. This email came in from Lauren. I was experiencing a lot of strange neurological symptoms that perimenopause made worse and underwent an MRI. They discovered a very large, and I mean kind of comically large, vein running through the center of my brain. I don't have my results with me right now, but I believe it's a venous malformation. This was 2 years ago. I've since started to experience dizziness if I'm bent over for too long. And I also wonder, is it hereditary? My grandmother died from a major aneurysm in her sleep, and I wonder if the same fate awaits me. I'm 48 years old. That's from Lauren.
So I would definitely get that checked out. The biggest concern with what you're describing would be something like an arterial venous malformation where an artery plugs into a vein inappropriately. Sometimes people can have tangles of arteries that drain through a single vein. Or you can have an artery that plugs directly into the brain, creating something called an arterial venous fistula. The risk of rupture from those kind of things depends a lot on the ins and outs of the imaging. Arterial venous malformations in general have a risk of rupture about 2 to 4% per year. fistulas can vary a lot to that. They vary so much, it's hard to give you a generalized number. We don't necessarily know that aneurysms and arteriovenous malformations are directly related, but definitely the history with having someone in your family who had a ruptured brain vessel problem certainly would lean me towards making sure that I was on top of getting it checked out and all the treatments that may be available depending on exactly what it is.
We're joined by Dr. David Penn today from Northwell Health. It's neurosurgery. If you have a question, good time to call is right now. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll be back. By now, you've heard the promos ad nauseum, but we have a new app, and it's really good. It's free. You can get it if you have it already and you have an Android. It should have updated itself, but it's a major upgrade over our last app. And again, it's a free app. If you have an iPhone, you got to go to the iPhone store, whatever they call it, and download the new version, install it, then get rid of our old version. You're going to find great functionality, a great bit of access to the shows and the features you love here at WAMC. So check it out, and thus endeth the lesson. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. David Penn today. Brain surgery, don't you know? L writes in, I had arteriovenous fistula a couple years ago, which was fixed with angioplasty. All's well now. Can you talk about why this happened and whether it might ever happen again?
It's a great question. So we don't know exactly why arteriovenous fistulas form.
And again, just tell us what that is briefly.
Sure. So an arteriovenous fistula, normally you have arteries flow through capillaries, flow through veins, and that helps lower the pressure from the high pressure arteries into the low pressure veins. In some situations, an artery and a vein can plug directly into each other. So you get high pressure blood flowing directly into a system that's designed to be low pressure.
How often does that happen?
Overall incidence can range, depending on the type of pathology. It's usually less than 5%.
Of the population?
Of the population, okay. May have one of these.
All right.
So if the high pressure blood is flowing into a low pressure system, that creates a problem because that system's not capable of handling it. One thought is that there are genetic causes for these things. So some people could be born with these, and we don't find them until we find them. Sometimes these are thought to be caused by trauma. So you have a trauma that causes damage to a vessel that eventually finds a new way of draining. Those are kind of the two leading thoughts. So why did this happen? We don't always know. But the good news is when we find them and we fix them, sometimes the treatments can be cures.
Oh.
So something that you don't have to worry about going forward.
We're joined by Dr. David Penn today. It's neurosurgery on the program. So you do a lot of work with brain tumors, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do people walking around know that they have a brain tumor? Sometimes you hear, oh, gosh, they checked me out and it's huge. Mm-hmm. How can you walk around and not know that you have the beginnings of something terrible?
There are a lot of tumors that just don't show symptoms, and a lot of the tumors that we deal with tend to be benign. Benign meaning unlikely to go to the liver or the lungs or things like that. Pituitary tumors in particular, which is something that I do a lot of. There are some studies that suggest 10 to 12% of the population will have one of these that we find by accident, meaning we're looking for something else and we find a lesion on your pituitary gland. Mm. There are also studies that at autopsy, when people have passed away from something else, 20 to 25% of the population may have one of these.
You're kidding me. That's mm-hmm. a lot.
There are another type of brain tumor called a meningioma, also a benign tumor. It grows from the protective layer of the brain. That is something that we find quite frequently. You know, someone comes in, they hit their head, and we find one of those. And in general, they tend to be small. If they're not putting pressure on the brain, if they're not putting pressure or causing swelling on the brain, they may not cause symptoms. And there are plenty of people who will go their entire life having this and never find out.
We're joined by Dr. David Penn today from Northwell Health. It's neurosurgery, 800-348-2551. tell me more about this protective layer of the brain. What is it? What's it made of? What does it do?
So there are three protective layers of the brain. There's the dura, the arachnoid, and the pia. And ultimately, they serve to, one, create a protective coating on the brain. So the dura is the outermost layer, and it's the toughest. It's like a leather almost. The arachnoid layer serves to house spinal fluid, which gives the brain a bath of fluid to kind of float in. And the pia is this almost like a cellophane that's very tightly adherent to the brain. And all of these layers work together to provide support and fluid and get rid of metabolites and all those kind of things.
But when you cut in, when you have to cut in, how do you repair that afterwards?
So some of those layers don't really have to be repaired. So the arachnoid and the pia, for instance, those aren't required to get put back together. When we do various brain surgeries and have to access the brain, we usually put the dura back together. The dura is considered important for also helping to keep spinal fluid within the skull. So once we've disturbed that layer in particular, we want to make sure we repair that perfectly.
But when you pierce the dura, where does the spinal fluid just flow free? Or, I mean, how do you keep it in place around the brain when you're working?
Well, when we need to do surgery, you don't need that spinal fluid.
Interesting.
So we will get rid of that. And especially in skull-based surgery, that's something that we actually intend to do because there are only so many things that can fit in the skull. And if you have a big brain tumor that's taking up a lot of space, we need to figure out ways to relax the brain, as we say, so that we can move the brain aside without injuring it.
What do you mean, move the brain aside?
We have to get to the tumor, right?
So you can't take it out and work on it, right?
The brain or the tumor?
The brain.
You can't take the brain
out. You got to move it aside.
I agree. You got to move the brain aside. So one of the things that we'll do is we have ways to get rid of spinal fluid and get rid of mass because, again, the skull is a little bit like a lockbox. So if you have a big brain tumor that's pushing things around, it can be hard to access that. So to keep the brain in place and not remove it, we will remove spinal fluid. We'll give medicines that help shrink the brain a little bit.
Yeah.
And what that can help us do is work between the folds of the brain to get to the tumor as opposed to, you know, charging right through the brain to get to the tumor.
Do you have to put the spinal fluid back or will it regenerate?
The body does that for us.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. It's Dr. David Penn. He's had quite enough of my inane questions. Let's go to yours. Sandra in Albany. Sandra, you're on.
Yes, hello, doctor. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I am calling because I am getting scheduled for a brain MRI because I have low sodium levels, and they're not sure why the secretion of these levels is happening. I will tell you, I'm in remission for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I've had a series of infections of late. So there's a lot kind of coming together, but I was wondering when she's looking for what's going on in the brain and whether there's tumors that are attributing to that, I would just like a better explanation.
Sure. So with the treatment that you've been undergoing, sometimes there's probably a pretty good chance that the medicines that you've been on may be causing this metabolic imbalance. With regards...
Excuse me, doctor. I've been in remission, just so you know, for like 4 years.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then one thing they may be looking for, in certain circumstances, pituitary tumors can actually cause low sodium levels. And the thought process is that as the pituitary tumor grows, it can put some pressure on your normal pituitary gland. And one of the important hormones that our pituitary gland secretes is a precursor to cortisol, which is our body's internal steroid. And one of the other things that that internal steroid does is help us regulate our salt and our water balances, particularly our sodium. So in theory, if you didn't have enough of that hormone around, that could be the reason for your low sodium. And I'm assuming your doctors have done a pretty thorough workup up to now. So it's probably reasonable to check that. Again, pituitary tumors, for the most part, are benign tumors. But that could be what they're looking for.
Sandra.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, that makes sense. I have had two cancers, so that makes sense.
All right, gotcha. Well, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. The pituitary is not very big, is it?
A normal pituitary gland is not very big, usually about a centimeter, let's say.
And even if you have a benign tumor on there, mm-hmm. that's got to be tricky, right? It's not a lot of real estate to get that thing off and keep the pituitary in shape.
So, well, that's where all our good technology comes in, right? With our endoscopes, we can pass that camera right in front of the pituitary gland so we can identify normal tissue and abnormal tissue. And we work with small instruments that occasionally people will have pituitary tumors that over-secrete hormones. And those tend to be a little bit smaller than the non-functioning ones. Mm-hmm. So we can work very carefully to remove just that abnormal tissue and leave the rest of the gland in place. And that's usually the goal of the surgery.
Dr. David Penn's our guest. It's Medical Monday, neurosurgery today. The number is 800-348-2551. Ted is in Suffield, Connecticut. Ted, you're on. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Appreciate taking the time. Question I have, I've got a history on my wife's side. Her father's sister died of a brain hemorrhage. His daughter died of a brain hemorrhage. My son had a subarachnoid head hemorrhage at 8, and then he died at 17 of a major hemorrhage at the base of his brain. Now I'm looking at my grandkids. And my two remaining daughters, I apologize.
Sorry, Ted. Take a minute here, buddy. It's okay.
Are there genetic tests that you can take? My daughters take their children in to have brain scans once a year where they put the dye in and they look. But I recall my son's doctor saying that was a crapshoot, you know, because if you may not show anything until it opens up. So,
All very good questions. So, unfortunately, genetic testing for these kind of things is poor. So, I think what your son's doctor said is probably correct. That you really just want to monitor. Yeah. There are some aneurysmal diseases can be related to various connective tissue disorders, which a lot of the manifestations you'd probably know about already in your family. There's probably not a lot of genetics that could be done, but it sounds like with a strong family history that your doctors are doing all the right things in monitoring. You know, I think keeping an eye on these things, especially with the family history, seems like you guys are all on the right path.
Sure. Okay. So just doing a yearly scan is sufficient, do you think?
I do. Okay. And then eventually, you know, if something does crop up, the good news is we'll catch it early, and some of the treatments for these are a lot better than they used to be. So.
Sure. Like coils or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
All right. I just seeing if things, progress.
Hey, Ted, thanks for thanks for the strength, man. And thanks for the call. We appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551. Let's go to David in Charlton. David, you're on with Dr. David Penn.
Hi.
Hi, doctor. And hi. I actually have pituitary tumors diagnosed in 2009. I had previous cancer about 10 years earlier. I had testicular cancer, unrelated, but energy dropped entirely. No one knew I had this tumor. Went in, and my endocrinologist, by deductive reasoning, kind of figured that this could be a pituitary tumor. Tested, and my prolactin was through the roof, and they imaged it. Didn't see anything locally. The Albany radiologist didn't see anything, so I went to Johns Hopkins, saw Dr. Salvatore. He said, you diagnosed it as, yes, you can see it right here on the film. Here's the pituitary tumor. My question is, I've since developed, I want to continue to monitor it. I take cabergoline twice a week, only a half a pill twice a week at this point, kind of keep the prolactin in check. And I want to image it, but about 10 years ago, I started having really severe reaction to gadolinium, which is an MRI contrast, as the doctor would know. And I want to know what my options are to continue to monitor this when they don't really want to do the MRI because of the reactions I've had with the gadolinium.
So one option in a lot of cases is they can actually pre-medicate you before you get the gadolinium. So you The protocols vary a little bit, but very generally it involves some steroids and some Benadryl, and then you go get the MRI, and hopefully that would be okay. With some of the larger tumors, I mean, it sounds like you might have a very small one. With some of the larger, with the smaller tumors, without the gadolinium, the MRI can be challenging to interpret. In larger tumors, sometimes you can avoid the gadolinium and you're just looking to make sure there's not a huge change or something like that.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think there are some creative solutions out there, right? You could make an argument to just get the MRI without the gadolinium. And, you know, if you can't see anything, you can't see anything. Maybe that's good enough to tell you that it hasn't grown. But I would imagine there should be some options out there to figure something out for you. The question maybe.
Second, I had a.
Go ahead.
Sorry, doctor.
No, go ahead.
I had a second question too related to this and that. Mike, I feel like I don't know if this is tied at all, and you could answer this. Is it possible that this would mess with my cortisol? I have rushes of adrenaline out of nowhere that will go on for long periods of time, and I've asked my endocrinologist locally in Albany whether or not my adrenals should be tested. They've never really tested them, however that's done, but I can't explain why this adrenaline, it'll last sometimes for days. I'll wake up in the middle of the night with it, and I'm wondering if it's tied to the pituitary tumor, whether it's small or not.
Your cortisol can be tied to the pituitary tumor. Again, with a small one, I would be a little surprised if it was negatively impacting those hormones. Sometimes with larger tumors, again, it can cause your steroid levels to not be sufficient, so too low. But again, with a known kind of prolactin-secreting tumor, it'd be hard to tie a direct effect to it.
Gotcha.
So,
okay, David, thanks for the call. Is MRI your go-to imaging in neurosurgery?
I like to brag that I think I order the longest MRI in Vassar Brothers.
What do you mean? Explain.
Well, I put people through a lot of pictures so we can get really high-resolution images so we know exactly what we're dealing with.
What part of the brain, and I assume most of it has been mapped, or at least a good portion of it nowadays, what part is still mysterious to you?
Probably too much of it.
Yeah. Is it still that way?
When we think of the brain in objective terms, right, we know a lot about, say, where your motor function is, where your language is, where your, you know, some of the memory formation is, some of the important functions that we don't think of on a day-to-day basis, balance, things like that. There's still a lot of things that happen within the brain, though, that I don't know if we fully understand or will ever understand. Right, I can't tell you where third grade memories are or, you know, all those kind of things. And there's behavioral problems that can come about from brain problems that are just a little more subjective. There's cognitive processes. I think we have to hold a lot of humility when we're dealing with the brain, because there's a lot of things that just, you know, it doesn't have an objective stamp, and you can't say, yep, that's why, that's the spot.
You may not live to see it, but someday a lot of people will know a lot more about the brain. It's the
Hopefully.
Way things go. I mean,
yes.
I just saw a headline somewhere from 9 days before the Wright brothers, and the headline was something like, oh, it'll take a million years of science to fly. And then 9 days later. So you never know what's going to happen. Let's grab one more call here. Dr. David Penn is our guest. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll take more calls. So if you want to call, 800-348-2551. Or voxpop@wamc.org for your email. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, go ahead.
What type of plastic is inserted between spinal segments for disc repair?
What kind of plastic is inserted between spinal segments for disc repair?
Is that, are you asking about disc repair in the neck or disc repair in the lower back?
Well, in the neck.
In the neck, yeah. So I'll be honest, I don't know the exact, you know, type of plastic per se. Sometimes, depending on what we're doing, there are disc replacements where we will basically clean out a degenerated disc within the cervical spine. And what we do is we put in its place a disc replacement, which is an artificial disc. It sometimes it has components of titanium and various types of plastics and things like that. When we're doing a fusion, though, which is probably the more common procedure that we do, we place a little block of titanium or sometimes a plastic called PEEK. We'll put that in the disc, and over time what happens, instead of allowing the mobility in the disc, fusion will occur between those two segments.
Jim, what do you think?
Okay, thanks.
Okay, apparently you passed Jim's test. The number's 800-348-2551. Dr. David Penn is with us. Neurology Today, back with more of your calls in a moment. Charlie Parker could listen all day to that man. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. Dr. David Penn is our guest. Dr. Penn is a neurosurgeon at Northwell Health Neurosurgery in Poughkeepsie. Now, we'll go to the email bag at voxpop@wamc.org for a few, and then we'll go back to the phones. Here's one. For pulsatile tinnitus, where imaging shows left venous stenosis and empty cella, is it advisable to get a stent? The doctor who does most of these procedures is in Long Island. Is this available everywhere, and is it advisable? And that's from Elizabeth.
So, at the end of the day, I think we'd have to look at all the information. You know, some of the concerns sometimes is if there is some stenosis or blockage in the veins in the brain that can, like we were talking about earlier, blood has to get in and get out appropriately. And if the blood isn't getting out appropriately, that can potentially raise the pressure within the head, which can cause a number of these symptoms. It raise the pressure. You can get this empty cella finding that the person alluded to. And sometimes with the back of the blood, you can get some pulsations that you hear in your ear because there's a major artery that passes by the eardrum.
Right.
So I actually have a partner who does a lot of those stents at Vassar Brothers. The idea is that if you decrease the blockage, you can potentially lower the pressure, allow the blood to flow more easily.
Yeah.
In general, it's considered a very safe procedure. They do it. They go through the wrist to access, the groin on this one. They go through the groin to access the vein to put a long stent across that opens up that vein.
Why do you have to go through the groin to get up there?
Because you need access to the vein. So when they do that procedure, they go in through the vein. When we treat things like aneurysms or arterial problems, a lot of times we can actually go through the wrist because we can access an artery in the wrist.
Okay. This one is from Mary in Pittsfield. Please discuss the different treatment options like mRNA, cell therapies, or freezing tumors. How far away are these treatment options? This is for glioblastoma.
Glioblastoma is a tough one. Glioblastoma is a very malignant, or malignant's not always the right word. Aggressive, I think, is a better word. Aggressive's aggressive brain tumor. Unfortunately, a lot of these mRNA viral treatments for that tumor, a lot of them are still experimental and in clinical trials. How far away are we? Hopefully we're closer to some promising treatments than obviously we were 5-10 years ago. The standard of care right now for glioblastoma is usually what we call maximal safe resection. We take out as much as we can, as safely as we can, followed by chemotherapy and radiation. And still, we're not that great at treating it. Recurrence can occur up to about 9 months out. Even with the best treatment, some of the maximal survival is still, on average, 16 months. It's one of those diseases, unfortunately, that we're not very good at. But hopefully some of these treatments that the writer is alluding to are closer in the pipeline than we think.
I mean, freezing tumors, we those of us who are parents have sometimes taken their kids to doctors for warts, and they use liquid nitrogen. Is that what they're going to use to do tumors?
I don't see that as something. That's not
how
something I've heard
it,
of.
Well, how do you freeze it otherwise?
Well, in general, in brain surgery, we don't freeze it.
Okay.
because I would imagine that would be damaging to a lot of the, yeah, the cells around it. You know, part of the challenge with glioblastoma, I always tell people it's like taking pink Jell-O out of a red Jell-O mold. Right. So finding that specific border is takes experience and practice and things like that. But again, I know they're trying a lot of things at a lot of major centers, and hopefully some of those will show promise.
I mean, do lasers get used at all in brain surgery?
It's rare. There are some carbon lasers out there that sometimes people will use to try to melt away tumors for removal. When we do laser-type brain surgeries, it doesn't really make it it's not like you can not avoid opening the skull and shoot the laser through the skull and take care of it. Obviously, radiation has come a long way, so radiation is used to treat various types of brain tumors, but still a lot of the times you have to know what you're dealing with before you can just treat it with radiation.
And when they use radiation, it has to be very targeted, right?
It's very targeted. So there are a number of different types of radiation. They all have their kind of pros and cons depending on the pathology that you're dealing with. But yes, it's all very targeted and with the goal of not affecting the surrounding tissue.
Our guest today is Dr. David Penn from Northwell Health. This email from Ralph. Any solution for a shunt that keeps needing adjustment? My mother has a shunt for 4 years for ataxy due to normal pressure hydrocephaly, but it keeps needing adjustment, and she keeps having issues with balance. Any longer-term or better solution? And that's from Ralph.
Unfortunately not. That can be one of the most challenging aspects of normal pressure hydrocephalus, finding the right setting for people. Sometimes if you drain too much spinal fluid, they can develop collections on the head, on the side of the head, which can become problematic under the skull.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to dial the shunt back up to get rid of those, and then you try to turn it back down again, and the symptoms get better, but you get those.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a vicious cycle. I wish I could tell you that we had a better solution, but I think a lot of neurosurgeons know that story well, and unfortunately there isn't always one.
Our guest, Dr. David Penn. One more email now, and then we'll go back to the phones. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Anitra in Kingston writes, question about brain health and cancer. What's the latest thinking on the causes of brain cancer, both children and adults, in terms of genetics and environment? What can individuals do to protect brain health? And that's from Anitra.
Well, the brain was designed very smart by whoever you want to believe designed it. So especially from a perspective of what the brain lets into it, the brain's very good at not letting things that don't belong in there. So the blood vessels that go to the brain have what we call tight junctions. So if you imagine a sieve, you could say that the areas of the blood vessels that let things out to nourish the brain is very small. It's very selective. It doesn't just let every chemical that we ingest into the brain. That being said, with brain tumors in particular, we don't have a specific causation that we know about. For instance, if you're a smoker and you develop lung cancer, we know that's probably the cause. A lot of thoughts have been the cell phones or the wires or things like that, and that hasn't directly been proven. So, you know, in terms of thinking about what causes them, we don't really have a great cause. The number of genetic syndromes that lead to brain tumors are quite small and generally quite rare in the population. So there's also not a lot of good genetic counseling. For instance, if you had a brain tumor, it's not clearly likely that your kids or you'll pass this downstream. Brain tumors in general tend to be thought of as a lot more sporadic.
Interesting.
Meaning it just kind of happens.
Is that because we don't know that much about it?
Could very well be. It could be that we don't have the information yet,
yeah,
right? Like you're alluding to.
You know, the blood-brain barrier I always find interesting. And the way you described it with your hands, kind of like a sieve almost, mm-hmm, and only certain size molecules get through, right? Is that mm-hmm how it works? Where does the stuff that doesn't get through, the chemicals or the whatever, where does it go? We have filters that filter out our blood. But if you have molecules, even if they're small, where do they go once they're up there?
You mean if they pass?
Yeah.
That's also a good question. So it will go into the tissue, and the tissue will either use that. So a lot of what those tight junctions let out are things that the brain needs, glucose, you know, oxygen, all those. That stuff gets used, and the byproducts of that can get secreted through the veins or out through the spinal fluid and things like that. So that's where those would go.
Dr. David Penn's our guest. Let's jump back to the phones. We'll go to Bennington and Teru's on. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Teru.
Right.
Simon.
So stipulated. Go ahead.
My dearest sister in California, and this has been going on since February, she did fall when she was running. And then about 2 weeks later, she had a, you know, the symptoms started happening. Anyway, they took care of her out there. They basically knocked out a whole bunch of things, but they came down to two different possible diagnoses. One was leaky spine, which may not be your
area of expertise.
That's okay.
Thank you. I don't have words. And the other one is possibly vestibular migraines.
Okay.
And she just started, I mean, it's just been awful. She's always been the Energizer Bunny, and she really can't do anything. And she feels like she's going crazy because she hears things in her brain and all this stuff. But anyway, she started going to acupuncture, and she's getting some relief. And but she's still going to go in and have an MRI of her spine. But do you have anything to say about this? Or
spinal fluid leak is definitely a thing that we see.
Yeah.
Especially sometimes after trauma, you know, if you hit your face. You can fracture the bones at the base of the skull. That can tear those protective layers that we talked about earlier, and you can get leakage of spinal fluid through the nose or the ear. Sometimes people can also have spontaneous leakage of spinal fluid from the spine. One newer area of thought about why this happens is you can have spinal fluid draining into the veins in the spine as well. So there are a lot of advanced studies and new things that they're trying to do to fix this problem. You know, from my level of expertise, I deal a little bit more with leakage of spinal fluid from the nose or the ear, because that's something that we can fix surgically at the base of the skull. But yeah, the symptoms can be quite troublesome. And ultimately, it can sometimes be very tough to find the cause. You know, a lot of times we'll have patients come into the office, they're actively leaking spinal fluid out of the nose, and we'll get the pictures.
I mean, they said if that happens, she has to go to the emergency room.
But when that happens and we get those pictures, sometimes it doesn't give us the answer, and we get to the point where we know we have spinal fluid leaking and we have to go do surgery and find the hole. But this can be a tricky problem, unfortunately.
Thanks a lot for the call. What does spinal fluid look like? What color is it?
It's like water.
Yeah?
Yeah, it looks like water.
So if it's coming out of your nose, you're not going to know right away. If you're just hanging out at the house, you get a Kleenex and blow your nose.
Sure. A lot of times people think they have allergies.
Yeah.
Right? So the first thing they'll do, they wind up their primary allergy medicine. Doesn't stop. Next thing you know, that her ear, nose, and throat doctor taking a look in the nose. A few more medicines later, it still hasn't stopped. And then eventually what we do is we'll take some of that fluid and we can send it to the lab and look for a specific protein. And if that protein comes back positive, we know it's spinal fluid. And then that usually leads us to get CT scans and MRIs. Sometimes we can see the problem on those pictures, but not all the time. But once we know that it's leaking, it's usually something that we have to go repair.
So by its nature, this is something that's going to be beyond the primary care physician. They're not going to catch this most of the time.
A lot of times, no, because by that point, it gets to the ear, nose, and throat doctor and things like that. And with some of the surgeries that I do with those pituitary tumors and CSF leaks, I work very closely with my ENT colleagues. They're my favorites. One of my favorites.
Yeah. Do you tip them?
Be careful. So we work together to diagnose these problems and then do the surgeries.
Now let's grab a call or two before we wrap it up with Dr. David Penn from Northwell Health. We'll go to Jim in Cheshire. Jim, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I've been diagnosed with, and I'm not sure if the correct words or not, but it's a trigeminal nerve problem, mm-hmm. especially in my lower jaw.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that they give me right now to take away the pain is carbenazepine.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me that there's really no cure for this. I'm just wondering if you had any further information.
Sure. So it sounds like you may have something called trigeminal neuralgia. Depending on the type of trigeminal neuralgia that you have, one type is a lot more effective for treatment than another type. But there are usually a lot of different options. So the first line is the medicine that it sounds like you're on, oxycarbamazepine or Tegretol. And a lot of times that can help with the symptoms. If the medicine doesn't help, there are some other medications that you can try. But there are also a number of procedures that we can do for this. So as a surgeon, I do the surgical procedure, where usually the thought process of why you have trigeminal neuralgia is you have a normal blood vessel and a normal nerve up against each other. And the blood vessel beats and eventually wears away the protective layer of that nerve, and then it starts firing abnormally. So one surgery we
That's
can
exactly
do
yeah.
is we make a small hole in the skull, and what we go in there to do is separate the nerve and the artery. And we place it's made of Teflon, or it looks like a little sponge. We basically place a sponge between the nerve and that artery. And if you have the right type of trigeminal neuralgia, that can be effective 80% of the time.
You'll leave the sponge.
Leave the sponge.
What's it made out of?
It's made of Teflon. It's called a Teflon. But I mean, if you look at it, it looks like a cotton kind of.
It's not absorbent, though,
mix.
Teflon, is it?
You don't want it absorbable because, again, that sponge is taking the artery off the nerve. You don't want that artery beating on the nerve. So
gotcha.
That would stay there, and then hopefully that can eliminate the symptoms in a lot of cases.
Jim, you want to follow up real quick? We're almost done here.
Just a quick follow. I know you said it was 80% successful. Is there a downfall with the other 20%? I mean, I've heard rumors that it could cause facial disfigurement and all these things. That's why I'm a little worried about it.
Risk of a facial disfigurement is probably not zero, but it's pretty low because we're not really touching that nerve. They're two separate nerves. So I would say that kind of thing is low. The feared complication is always that the pain could get worse, but that generally happens in a very small percentage of cases.
All right, Jim, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Joseph writes in, there's going to be promising treatment for tumors using shark antibodies. You think? Did you ever see the movie Deep Blue Sea?
Anything could happen.
I'll tell you, my kids, wife and kids were watching that, and it's a terrible movie. Hey, Dr. David Penn of Northwell Health, thanks for being here, man.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Support,
always fun.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, introducing Dr. Arnaldo Martinez, performing minimally invasive surgeries for spine-related conditions, nlh.org, for details. Once again, thanks to Dr. David Penn of Northwell Health for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the call. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. Thanks for the emails. Let's see, what else can I thank you for? Just thank you for your patience. You know I can't read. You know I really have no idea about medicine, and yet you listen. So thank you. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. Phone screened by Jim Mountier. And I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Car Maintenance and Repair with Gordon Fricke. We'll see you too.